What, rats deserting a sinking ship, I'll tell you. Got off this stage like something embarrassing was going to happen. My name's Bob Darrow, and I am alcoholic. It's only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book entitled Alcoholics Anonymous, the ability to remain sponsorable, and a persistent and consistent effort in our primary purpose of trying to forget ourselves and devote our lives to helping others. Consequently, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering medication since October 31st, 1978. And that's the great miracle in my life. I'm going to do the best I can here this morning. I'm all prayed up, so that's not a problem. I got a bad case of bronchitis. Whew. And I don't like being sick because I'm inside me too much anyway. You know, and when I'm sick, I'm even more up in here. And it's like being put into a little prison cell. I don't like it much. I'm tasked with talking about my experience with step three. And what I found the most useful when I hear people share their experience, I want to hear about your difficulties. I want to hear about your struggles. I don't want to hear how you just so easily did all this stuff and rode off to the road of happy destiny, because I need to know that my resistance and my difficulties with this are not unique. And I had two minor problems with step three, step one and step two. When I got those, step three was kind of automatic. You know, the word decision comes from the Latin word scissore. It's the root word meaning to cut, like in scissors and incision, when a surgeon cuts into a patient. When you make a decision, all your alternatives have been cut away. And if step one and step two are true, if the ABCs, which is an extrapolation of step one and step two, are true, that A, I am alcoholic and cannot manage my own life. And then there's a period there. There's no caveat. It doesn't say, and cannot manage my own life when I'm drinking. Period. Can't manage my own life, drunk or sober. And I'll tell you something, it's my experience. My life's more unmanageable sober than it ever was when I was drinking. Because alcohol gave me certain emotional management tools. At least I could blot stuff out, and that cannot manage my own life. That probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. And you didn't have to sell me on that. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd been relapsing for about 7 years. I'd been to every great psychiatrist on the planet. I'd been to so many treatment centers. I'd did so many types of therapy, so many diagnoses, so many various medications. If it came up on the radar and it looked like it was going to help me, I took a run at it. My mother was a therapist. She got me in to see people. And I did everything. I primal screamed. I was hypnotized. I gestalt therapy, rational emotive therapy with Ellis himself. I mean, Dr. Silverman. I mean, I had some amazing stuff. And no matter what I did, no matter what new diagnosis, new medication, new therapy, new breakthrough that I would incur, in no time at all, I would recede back to being me again. And that was never very good. Because back to being me again is back to being the guy who's full of anxiety and the guy who doesn't fit anywhere, the guy who's prone to depression, the guy who can't seem sober to get myself up off myself. I can't get free sober like I did when drinking worked. And I'm stuck. I'm stuck in a trap I can't spring. And yet, by this time, alcohol has turned on me. And what is the worst blow of alcoholism, in late-stage alcoholism, to guys like me, is after it ruins you, after you hate yourself, when you need the effect of the alcohol the most, it pulls the plug on the effect. And last couple years of my drinking, I drank in depression and loneliness and desperately chasing a party I couldn't catch. And I couldn't stand it. I am the guy who talks about in the book. I get to a place for many years I couldn't imagine life without it. And then the reality of what life was with it now and how what has happened incurred in me. And I can't imagine life with it or without it. Because you can get to a place where drinking is horrible. And not drinking is horrible. And that's a bad spot. And I tried to take my own life at that point in 1978. And some of you figured out I couldn't do it. It's either that or this is the most spiritual meeting you've ever been to. And I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And very much, my experience was very much like Sheldon's and a lot of people. My real problem, by this time, I got step one. The illusion that someday, some way, I'm going to control my joint, enjoy my drinking had been finally crushed. And it was only crushed one way. I couldn't crush it intellectually. I crushed it by trying and failing and trying and failing and desperately trying and failing, throwing every chemical in the mix, trying to get back to that feeling of freedom and failing, and here I am, standing on a bridge in 1978 trying to get up enough courage to make it all stop. And I couldn't do it, and I ended up in this detox, and I met a man who was a doer. He was one of those guys. I met him because he brought meetings into the detox twice a week. He was a guy that Alcoholics Anonymous was the center of his life. He had a big life, but A was the middle of it. And he was my first example. And I think we're brought together by divine appointment. He was the perfect guy for me. Perfect guy for me. And he started helping me to get connected here at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a hard time. This whole God thing was like a brick wall between me and you. I get sober. I'm a sort of an atheist. I was a wannabe atheist. I've known some real atheists. You have to be very religious about your atheism to be a good atheist. I'm not that guy. What I am truly is I'm a guy who's afraid of God. I'm a guy who in the core of who I am, no matter what you say, no matter what it says in the Bible and the ministers, no matter what you tell me, I know something. That if there is a God, I don't measure up. I ain't good enough. And so I'm the guy who, if I just suspect you don't like me, I'm going to not like you first. Right? So I threw God away because I think it's, why not? Because I'm never going to be good enough for him anyway. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsor wanted me to start praying. I told him I couldn't because I didn't believe in God. And he said, I didn't ask you to believe in God. I asked you to pray. I said, well, if I prayed, I didn't believe in God, I'd be a hypocrite. And he informed me that I suspected I was a hypocrite most of my life anyway. just do it. And I just started doing it. And I started to have an experience. I was one of the guys that affected me a lot in my early sobriety. It was a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. And I heard Chuck say something that has rung home with me many, many times in my sobriety. He said that he'd been surrendered by the bottle, and then in sobriety was eventually surrendered by life itself. And I get that. Not consciously, but unconsciously, I thought that the unmanageability in my life was tied to my drinking. Unconsciously, I thought that with a clear mind, some principles, going to meetings, a deep faith in God, surely then my thinking will be pretty good here. And I can maybe run my life again. Because I tell you, I discovered something that was hard to believe, but I was more addicted to running my life than I was to drugs and alcohol. And if you don't think that's true, Try to go a day without worrying about you. I was obsessed with me and my life and trying to run it. And the action, the juice of making the decisions and the juice of figuring and maneuvering, it gave me an illusion of power. And the truth is I don't have power. But I'll take the illusion. And I had to crash and burn several times in sobriety. And I had step three kind of spoon-fed to me in little bits and pieces. In the book, when it talks about the ABCs, right after that, it uses a word that it's a pretty strong word. It says being convinced of those three things. Convinced is like absolute. You know, it's not saying, can you kind of see that, Bob? It says being convinced. We were at step three. In step one in chapter three, it talks about taking step one in a place that to some of us is kind of alien. It says we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. Chamberlain used to say it all the time. This is an inside job. That's why, if that's true, that explains the intellectual failures of trying to make Alcoholics Anonymous an academic effort. Because it doesn't happen up here, it happens in here. And we learned that we had to fully concede. And being convinced is, in the pit of my stomach, in that place where I know things that is beyond the cognizant chatter and the talk to myself in my head, is a place where you can know stuff. And in that place am I convinced that I am alcoholic and cannot manage my own life, period. That probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism, that God could and would if he were sought. I was in my first couple months of sobriety, and I'm out of the treatment center, and I go to this meeting, and there's a guy there, Joe W. Joe was one of the instrumental people in my early sobriety. There was several. And Joe comes up to me after the meeting, and Joe said to me, he said, kid, I was listening to you. You need to do step three. That was in my early sobriety. I like to go to discussion meetings because I thought my name was, does anyone want to share? Yeah. And Joe came up to me after the meeting. He said, listen to you, and kid, you need to take step three. And I said to Joe, I said, oh, Joe, to be honest with you, I can't. He said, why not? I said, I don't believe in God. He said, you don't have to believe in God to take step three. I said, Joe, come on, look at the steps. Steps were on the wall. I said, look at step two, came to believe. Step three, God as we understood him. I don't have any of that. He said, you don't have to believe in God to take step three. And he said, listen, kid, I'll make you a promise. He pointed to a chair in the Alano Club. He said, if you'll turn your will and your life over this chair, I guarantee you an instant miracle. So I said to Joe, okay, Joe, I turned my will and my life over the chair. And Joe gets a big smile on his face. And he says, the miracle is your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. And I didn't get my feelings hurt. I just, like when he said it, I thought, yeah, that'd be right, wouldn't it? Because the veil was starting to lift. I was starting to wake up to a deeper reality than my own self-justification and rationalizations. And the deeper reality is objectively, if you would have watched me, as maybe your loved ones and family and friends have been watching you when you got sober, for God's sakes, could anybody watching me come to any conclusion other than whoever's making decisions for Bob must be out to kill him? And yet, up here, I make it make sense. When Silkworth says we can't differentiate the true from the false, to us our alcoholic life seems the only normal one, I make bizarre things normal in my head. I can come to after doing something really bizarre, and I don't know why I did it. Oh my God, I don't know why. I can't believe I did that. Give me 5 minutes, I'll come up with a perfectly logical excuse why that happened. And it's not my fault. So I was starting to wake up a little bit. And waking up is a slow, sometimes tedious process. Some of us, as we're waking up, get a little grumpy. Because we don't want to be waking up. I was enjoying the daydream about Bob's life. The daydream of Bob's life has always been more attractive to me than Bob's actual life. But my actual life is beautiful. It's my judgment of it that makes me crazy. And so I started down this process. It started with taking actions of someone, just like Sheldon talked about, who didn't believe but was willing to believe. And God started to show up. And I finally broke through what I've come to think of as the God barrier. I'm a God-resistant guy for many reasons. One is I feel guilty. I feel ashamed of myself. I don't feel like I measure up. And besides that, I've always suspected he had my job. Because if someone's going to be God, right? And I'm starting to have an experience. God's starting to show up. I love that line in We Agnostics where it says, God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. From the moment I demonstrated through my action just a small bit of willingness, God came the rest of the way. And I'm a skeptic. I didn't come to believe easily. I mean, it wasn't the first 10 coincidences that convinced me. It was probably 100. I mean, I had to be overwhelmed by my own experience to know that there was something going on here. And that's what happened to me. And I got down on my knees with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was about almost a year, not quite a year sober, and I said the third step prayer on page 63. And my sponsor had been hammering me. He got on this kick. It seemed like every time I turned around, he'd want me to read page 60 through 63. And those of you that have read that, I do it different. I have the guys I sponsor, I change it to the first person because it's written in the third person, which means it's about you. Make it about me. And I was reading it about you and could easily see that you really were like they're talking about in here. I mean, there were some people in here trying to run the whole show. And if you don't think that's true, go to your group's business meeting. You'll see some people, control freaks. Right. But Bill says in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions that we will be quick to see our defects of character in others before we can ever see them in ourselves. And I could see your selfishness and self-centeredness. I could see that you were trying to run the whole show. But when I look at me, I don't see it. Because I look through filters of self-justification and rationalization. I have this a gift to explain things to myself. And I could see it's you, but I can't see it's me. And there's a thing that happens when God's grace and the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous meet on rare occasions with my untreated alcoholism, and something can happen. Pain and grace cause the perfect storm when they come together. And I had one of those days, early sobriety, that I used to have on occasion, because I hadn't really worked the steps yet. You know, I'm saying the third step prayer, but I'm not getting it. You know, I'm the guy who gets down on my knees. I say the third step prayer. I'm off my knees, and 5 minutes later, I'm in my head running the universe. I'm driving to work having conversations in the car with people that aren't in the car, right? Because I'm playing God. I'm running the universe. And I'm reaping the anxiety and all that crap. It's the anxiety of playing God. I'm reaping that. And I don't know how to not do it. I don't know how to stop being the way I am. And I get to work this morning. It's one of those days, you know, sometimes you ever have a day where you just wake up and you got this little edge in you. Like it's a little apprehension, you know. You can't really put your finger on it. It's just a feeling that there's some crap going to happen today. You know what I mean? You don't know what it is, but you got to be on high alert and watch for it. And if you've ever had days where you're watching for it, it's amazing how you magnetize it and bring it to you. So it's one of those days, and I get to work, and I work as a cashier in a retail store. All this merchandise has come in, a couple pallets of merchandise. It has to be priced. The shelves have to be rearranged, has to be put on the shelves. And I'm back there with these pallets. I'm killing myself for the good of all, putting all this stuff up. I got two other guys I work with. They're doing nothing. They're standing up having coffee at the cash register, telling jokes with the customers, while I'm back here killing myself here. The boss comes in. He doesn't even say, "Oh, Bob, look what you're doing for all of us." He doesn't even acknowledge what I'm doing. He's up there with the two idiots drinking coffee and, you know, right? But I don't say nothing. It's like, as my sponsor says, it's like a spring in the pit of my stomach that life just starts to tighten a little bit. And it just, because I keep score. Humbly. Keep score. And by the end of the day, I'm a basket case. I'm just so up to here. Well, I got to meet. I'm a secretary of this meeting at the old Alano Club, and it's a rush hour meeting, and I got to get over there right after work, and I got to stop at this grocery store and get some styrofoam cups for the meeting. And I'm kind of in a hurry because I'm meeting a new guy there, so I'm sort of on a mission from God, I guess. I don't, you know. And I'm in a hurry to get there. And I get to the grocery store, and I get the three-pack of styrofoam cups, and getting the 12 items or less line behind a woman with 15 items. I've counted them twice. I just remember, I want justice, right? I want to bring the manager out of the office. I want to make him count them underneath the sign, but no, slow me down, so I just tighten that spring up. I get out in Maryland Parkway, which is three lanes one way, three lanes another way, and I get in the fast lane. Now, everybody who has an IQ over 10 knows that the fast lane is the left lane, right? Well, I'm in the fast lane behind a woman driving 5 miles an hour below the speed limit, and I'm in a hurry. And did you ever get on somebody's bumper and just will them to drive faster? I'm surprised I didn't have a brain aneurysm. There was one point in there, I remember the thought, I'm just going to floor it. I'm going to push us both into oncoming traffic. We'll probably be killed, but she'd see. I don't do it because I just think it, and I just finally get to the meeting. My newcomer's already there, and he's sitting, you know, in the back of the room. I said, "Get up here, sit up here." Laid the literature out, got waiting for the perfect two guys, chairman and co-chairman, that are going to put on a good meeting. Carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous for my new guy. Waited, got the right two guys. Told the one guy, said, "Listen, I got a new guy here, so let's not read chapter 5. Let's read chapter 3, more about alcoholism for the new guy." And he said, "Yeah, sure." You start reading chapter 3. I'm watching my new guy. I think he's getting it. I can picture him getting a year mentioning my name, you know, it's good stuff. And they're done reading chapter 3, and the guy says, "Does anybody have anything they want to start off with?" And some guy I'd never seen before starts talking about shooting heroin. Well, some old guy doesn't know anything about that, interrupts him and says, "You can't talk about that here. This is Alcoholics Anonymous." Well, some other guy jumps the old guy and says he can talk about whatever he wants to talk about here. And it's like the meeting from hell, right? And the whole vision of my new guy getting the years like smoke in the wind. It's just dissipating. By the end of the meeting, I'm insane. I'm ready to quit Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the only one who cares here. The only one who gets it. Stupid people in AA. So I go home. And like I've been conditioned like Pavlov's dog to call Dick, my sponsor. And I get on the phone and he says, "Read page 60 through 63. And I get to the bottom of page 60. And it says, "Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, the other employees, the customers, the people in the grocery store, the people in traffic, the people sharing in the AA meeting in his own way. If only people would do as he wished, the show would be great, and everybody, including myself, would be pleased, and life would be wonderful. And for the first time in my life, it was me. It had been you, but it was the first time in my life, it was me. I mean, it was really me. And here's the crazy thing. It's not like I just became that guy. I'd been that guy all my life and couldn't see it. As Chamberlain would say, you can only see what you can see when you can see it. I've been the guy trying to run the whole show forever and never knew it. And wondered why I'm always the guy that's leaving. Why I'm the guy that's losing the job. Why I'm the guy who's losing friends. Why I'm the guy who's in trouble all the time. Why I'm the guy who's uptight. Why I'm the guy who emotionally abstinence is so painful that I seek relief again in the bottle. I have no idea. In our book, it says that our misery is of our own making. It arises out of ourselves. And then I love this line. It says that the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. If you're new here, we're not saying that you have a small problem with self-centeredness. We're saying here's the worst of humanity, and that thing up in the stratosphere is you. You're an extreme example, and yet you don't think so. You're sitting here thinking, oh, I'm not that bad. You just qualified. You're just right there. Because we usually don't think so. And I don't think so. I'll see it in you, but I can't see it in me. And my awakening to what's wrong with you has never changed me. Am I not? And what is this? What drives this? You know, my grand sponsor used to say that there was one problem and it contained all problems. And that was conscious and unconscious separation. And he said it was between me and you and me and God. And I think it's even between me and me. I've tried to be so many things to so many people so often and for so long that I don't know who I am anymore. I'm lost not only from God, and I'm not lost and don't feel like I fit and separate from you. I'm lost from me. You really see that when you're new. I was a new guy single when I got sober. You ever watch two new people single go out on their first date? They'll say things to each other like, well, where do you want to go eat? Oh, I don't know. Where do you want to go eat? Oh, I don't know, wherever you want to go. Well, what kind of food do you like? I don't know, what kind of food do you like? I mean, it's like you don't even know who you are, right? I'm trying to be so many things to so many people. I'm lost. And God's something that is separate from me. And you are something that is separate from me. That's why alcoholism is such a lonely, lonely business. I got too much of me between me and you, and I got too much of me between me and God. And I live in this, what Wilson refers to in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, is a state of anxious apartness. And we all know that feeling when we're sober and we go into a room full of people and it's all of them, and then there's me. Separate and apart from, as if there was some sort of invisible yet impenetrable barrier between me and life itself. That whiskey used to melt away. Whiskey used to allow me to come out and play. Whiskey used to connect me to life and to people and even to myself. And now I live in this desolation called untreated alcoholism. Their book refers to it as a spiritual malady, and I got it. I got it bad. And what is the root of all this? Well, our book says selfishness, self-centeredness. that we think is the root of our troubles. Isn't it odd that's the root of all of this, and it always has been, and yet I can't see it. I remember, it's silly today with today's consciousness, but I remember clearly being in a meeting, and there was a guy there, Happy Jack, and he used to always quote this part of the book, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And, you know, Jack was a Cadillac salesman who had a different loner Cadillac every day, and it was always the same color as the suit he was wearing, you know. And it was, selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our troubles. I sit there and you look at him and go, yeah, I bet it is, Jack. But I don't know what it means. And I don't think I'm self-centered. I don't think I'm selfish. I would share my bottle of wine with you. And I was sitting in a meeting, and it was one of those meetings where you go around the room, and it's tables. And I don't know about you guys, but if I'm in a meeting and they're going around the room, when it's on that side of the room, I'm free to do what I like to do the most. Think about me and daydream about Bob and my money and my job and my future. And so I'm not really paying attention. I'm just into Bob land. I'm in Bob land over here. But it's starting to come around. And as it's coming around, I have to start paying attention because I'm going to share here pretty soon. And I'm starting to listen. And this woman starts talking about self-centeredness, which didn't really apply to me until she used the term. She said, and I went through my life completely self-absorbed. And I'm sitting there thinking about my finances, my sex life, my future. I'm thinking about what I'm going to share when it's my turn, what you're going to think of what I'm going to share. I'm even moving around in the chair to try to find the right seating position to sit when I share, because you want to get that nice mix of humility and like authoritarian look. You you don't want to look too full of yourself, but you don't want to look too humble either. You know, you got, it's like a. And she uses the term self-absorbed, and I thought, oh my God, I'm totally absorbed in myself. That's what self-centered means. It means that my primary concern and focus is on me. That my consciousness, its default position is me. And it's always been me. I don't know about you guys. I don't wake up in the morning just wondering about you. Unless you have something to do with me, I don't really care. I wake up in the morning worried about me, worried about my day. I'm always checking my future, not checking yours. I don't even care. I'm checking mine. Totally self-consumed. And it started to make sense to me why I don't feel like I fit out here in the world, because self-centered, self-absorbed, self-focused, self-obsessed guys like me, the truth is, I don't live out here in the world. I live up here in the control center where I try to play God. There's a line in this part of the book. It says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. You could have put me in a lie detector when I was new and say, Bob, are you playing God? And I said, no, I'm not. But I was playing God, didn't know it. Here's the guy I am. I'm a collector of obvious and notable wrongs in life. I notice things. I notice things in AA. I notice things at work. I notice the wrong people. I notice the stupid people. I notice the people that he's selling Amway after the meeting. Four cups of coffee, and he puts 50 cents in the basket. You selfish taker, you. I notice these things. Here she's getting up, walking around. Everybody's already seen her boob job. Sit down. Stop it. I notice these things, right? And I keep score. And I wait until it's overwhelming. Like, I feel like I'm going to have a nervous breakdown with all these wrongs that need to be righted. And I go to my sponsor and I start dumping them on the table to him. You know, everything's out of line. And he would say this to me. He said this to me 3-4 times when I do this with him. I don't know. He'd say, "You have to quit playing God." And I just look at him. I'm not playing God. I'm reporting some accurate information here. I'm not playing God. But I climbed up on the throne of judgment, looking down on people in that state of smug superiority, separate and apart from, because that's what my ego does the most. It judges. It notices. It creates. I think the ism in alcoholism is I separate myself. And that's what the ego does. In this egocentric sickness, the book says it's the bondage of self. I don't know what you call it, but it's got me. And there's a loneliness about it. And it's where my depression comes from. It's where my worry and self-centered fear comes from. It's where my problems come from. It's where I build cases in my head. I have, you know, in my first couple years of sobriety, I went through 9 jobs in just a few years. That speaks volumes of self-will run riot right there. I had a friend, Jimmy Williams, used to say that. First time I heard him say this, it so hit me. He said, "I worked over 50 places in my life." He said, "I never worked anywhere where they did it right." He said, "Some of those places have been doing it wrong successfully for decades." And as he said it, I thought to myself, yeah, and I'm always the guy that's leaving. I'm always the guy that's leaving. And so I am in this state of separation, and I can't, I'm hooked into this bondage of self. And there's a great line in the book, and it's really true. When I heard that woman use the term self-absorbed, the book says, the knowledge that you're self-centered does not relieve you of the bondage of self. Wouldn't it be great if it did? You'd come to your senses and you'd go, oh my God, I'm self-centered. Glad I know that. I'm just not going to be that way ever again. You know, I mean, but self can't move self out of the center. You can't change your basic default position. The book says we had to have God's help. Is there anything here that I don't need God for? Yeah, you get to get dressed in the morning. That's about it. And so I had to have God's help. And the problem, here's the dilemma that I face. I can pray and I can say that third step prayer over and over and over again with genuine intention, and I can't carry it out. I started thinking something was really wrong with me, because I would get on my knees every morning and I'd say that third step prayer. And I have a lot of faith in God. God saved my life. I know this by now. The evidence is overwhelming. I know it's God. But I can't seem to carry out this decision in step 3, no matter how genuine and how much I want to. I can't seem to carry it out. I'm the guy who gets down on his knees and prays and doesn't even make any difference. I'm back into my head running the universe before the day's over, causing problems and conflicts within me mostly. You learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, it doesn't take you long here to learn to keep your mouth shut. You learn restraint of tongue and pen. And you learn that because until you learn it, you make so many mistakes telling people what they need to know, and that never works out well. But inside me, I cook and I stew on my own emotional juices in the conflict from playing God. I mean, I may have found a way to diminish the outside problems, but in here, not so much. Maybe it's even worse. And on page, bottom of page 63, it's as soon as I come off my knees from saying the third step prayer, it gives me an instruction. It says, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us never attempted. Though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once, which in my case was several years, unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom. I read that one day and that word hit me, blocking me. I felt stuck. It's like you can see the promised land, you just can't get there. I can see, and I'm not stupid, I get the benefits of getting my life out of the hands of the idiot. I just can't do it. Right? I can't seem to get any traction on letting God really and truly have my life. I intend to. And the reason is I've never gone through the ego reduction that's involved in steps 4 through 9. Which is really what actualizes the decision in step 3. The problem is I'm so full of myself. And when I started that, when I did my third, fourth step, I finally did it out of the book. The first two were very interesting exercises. But there was no massive ego reduction. Because I never did, this was our course. And I never had that inside job, that realization that changes the world and makes me wrong. It's funny, they trick you into this, making this list of resentments, which is really what they're really saying, they won't tell you this, is make a list of all your judgments. And then every time I went through this was our course, and then the last two things in that resentment section, I got to see it from an entirely different angle, and I realized how wrong I'd been about my mother, and how wrong I'd been about my dad, and how wrong I'd been about the women in my life, and the bosses, and the society, and the police, and my sister, and every time I had the realization, it was notching down this ego that plays God, and I was becoming smaller, and I didn't know it. That's why at the end, you know, for some of us, when we come out the backside of step 4, you're back to where you were when you were brand new. When I was brand new, something had happened to me coming off that bridge and that failed suicide attempt. There was a transformation, and I was a smart guy. I was always the guy who, you fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell him much. I knew everything. I'm the I know guy. I can be dying, the most pathetic person in the room, and I'm smarter than everybody there at the same time. You can't help me. I'm a closed system. My ego is so big that I can't listen to anyone to hear anything new. I can only listen to see how I'm already right. I'm a self-contained system. Nothing new gets in, so nothing changes. Coming off that failed suicide attempt, I had enough of me beaten out of me. And I remember sitting in the detox waiting for the meeting to start, and I knew something. I knew one thing. I knew one thing for sure. I knew I didn't know. I really knew. I knew I couldn't even trust my head anymore. It was the first time in my life that I'd ever been in a state of surrender. At a little over 4 years sober, coming out the backside of the fifth step, after notching down and seeing how wrong I was and wrong I was once again at the place where I knew the most important thing you'll ever, ever know is I knew that I didn't know. One of the things that I've practiced and I've worked on, and it's been my struggle for all these decades, is to trust God. It's easy to believe. There, as we sit in this room, there are alcoholics with tremendous faith in God drinking themselves to death. It's not enough. I have to actualize it with trust. And that's been my struggle. Because I have an ego that you can't kill it. It won't. You can't get rid of it. It's always, it never, what the best I've ever found, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, is I'm placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, not only from alcohol, but from me. Do you know the voice in your head that seems to be, it's a seductive voice. It's the voice that's, it's a reasonable voice. It's not like your sponsor's harsh voice. This is a voice that understands you. This is a voice that says things like, don't listen to the old timers, they're old. It says things like, oh, they said to stay away from that new girl. They probably want her for themselves. You know, it says you don't have to pay all your taxes. The government's wrong. You know, it just said, don't take that from your boss. You have rights. Quit your job. You know, it says all that stuff. It's the voice of the enemy, but it's a seductive voice. And if I'm in a position of neutrality, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, my reality seems to shift. Then that chatter in my head becomes like music in the doctor's office. It's there, but it don't own me. When you're in neutral, you can rev your engine all you want. You ain't going nowhere. It don't run my life. But if it can scare me enough, and self-centered fear, not only is it the chief activator of all my defects, it's the muscle of my ego. If it can scare me or worry me enough, I'll start engaging. This will start to make sense to me again. I'll start, when it starts whispering to me, it's little stuff. It's like little pathetic things about how people don't like me. I'll go, yeah, they don't, do they? It will get my attention if it can worry me enough. And so, over 39 years later, I'm here to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous is still about what Joe told me in 1978, that the whole purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is so that I can get my life out of the hands of the idiot. But the idiot's still in town. And the idiot is studying AA literature. The idiot's getting smarter. The idiot's clever. The idiot knows your weak spots. And I need a sponsor, and I need God's grace, and I need the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need the accountability of not only a sponsor, but the people I sponsor. I have to be right in the middle. So God's grace can flow through me. Never of me, but sometimes it gets to go through me. And there is not a feeling in the world better than being useful to God and Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Bob. We had a little conversation right before. I know he's